This is Scan, and I'm Hal Dragseth. Albert Sample is known as Old Racehorse. His life has been marked by brutality and despair. The pattern of abuse started when his mother, Emma, witnessed the death of her mother.
And the scene is somewhere in western Louisiana. And Emma and the other two sisters that she had, Bama and Sally, they were on their way to church, and her mother and father in a wagon. And on the way to church, the wagon ran over a rut and one of the wheels came off. And Charlie, who was Emma's father, he asked one of the biggest girls, Bama, to help him lift the bed of the wagon up so that he could put the wheel back on. And Lily, who was Emma's mother, my grandmother, she insisted that it was too heavy for Bama to pick up. And she was proceeded to push her away and do it herself. And she was 9 months pregnant at the time and expecting the fourth child just any day. And there ensued an argument over who's going to help pick up this wagon. He was saying that's what's wrong with them kids. They ain't worth nothing because you won't let them do nothing. But she insisted, and she bent down to pick it up, help her pick it up again. And in a fit of rage, he got a single tree out of the wagon and hit her across the back with it. And she died within a matter of a few minutes after that, laying there on the side of the road. And in the meantime, the youngest girl was born of the four sisters, Elzada. And Emma was 4 years old at the time when that happened. And only I got to see how deep those scars were, how deep that hurt her. I can just imagine, you know, how would someone feel 4 years old and seeing that the one thing in the world that you love snuffed out right in front of your face? I mean, what do you do? Who can you tell? And then I had to be taken in by Grandma Duck, who already had 8 or 9 kids of her own. And Emma looked just like her father, and Grandma Duck just despised her. And she abused her and kicked her around, treated her just like, almost like an animal. So when Emma got 15 years old, she ran away, and she took to all fields as a prostitute. That's all she knew to do. There weren't many chances for black women during the early 1900s, especially one that no education, no skills, or nothing. All she had was a body and a lot of guts. And she started gambling. She learned how to gamble, and she became a professional gambler and a bootlegger. That was the life she knew. And it seemed like for a period in her life before I came that she was kind of getting over the hump, if you will, just barely beginning to see a little light. And she met a strapping buck that reminds me, I knew him well, Alan Sample, the man's name, that last name that I have. He reminds me so much of Sidney Poitier. He looked just like him. I mean, a handsome buck. And Emma just flipped over him. Plus, he was a good gambler, and he's the one that taught her how to gamble. And Emma got pregnant with a white cotton broker in the town, and his name was Mr. Albert, whose first name that I have. And all along, I guess Blue kind of felt like that was his baby that she was carrying, and she never told him differently. So when I was born on February the 7th, 1930, Longview, Texas, raining and snowing, right behind the old jailhouse, Gregg County, Precinct Number 1, Hoot Garner was the sheriff. And the reason I remember that so well is because Emma whipped me a many, many day with the coat hangers to get that into my head at how to say that. And she could wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I could rattle that up. Oh, if I was born on Friday, 3/27, day of February, rain and snowing, right behind the old jailhouse, Gregg County, Precinct Number 1, Mr. Hoot Garner was the sheriff. But when Blue walked in that room and took one look at me, he knew that I was not his kid. And I looked like a white baby, light eyes and light-complected like my father. But now she had somebody to blame for all the trouble that had been in her life. So I received the very brunt of all of that pain and hurt that Emma had been exposed to all of her life. And now there was me. And it begins with me. When I was 4 years old, ironically, the same kind of thing that happened to her when she was four, I came into that same realization when I was four. I knew what was going on about me. I knew what it was to do in my house. I had responsibilities. I had a job to do. I helped sell the bootleg whiskey and collect the money and watch for the guys that was shooting dice in the game to see that nobody sneaked crooked craps in on Emma. And watching out the doors and windows for the police to see that nobody would raid us. And when she drank, I remember many times that just out of nowhere, she'd lose a bet or two, and she'd just look over in it at me, and I'd be sitting there looking out the window on a little crate. And she would just beat the living hell out of me because she said I was bad luck and that I was janky to her. That's the reason she couldn't win, because I brought up bad luck. And I couldn't understand how she could be mean to me. And I loved her more than anything in the world. And there was nobody probably in the world that did love her but me. And then Emma got run out of town when I was six by the Ku Klux Klan. And I didn't see her no more till I was 10. And it wasn't easy in that town. Where did I belong? Which side do I play on? Who wants me on that team? And the kids at school were so cruel. You know, they could always say the ugly things to me, like, your mama latch white men and things like that. And I could, it was true, I couldn't say nothing. I used to wish that I'd wake up the next day and my skin would be black. And I was scared to leave, because I didn't know where to go. And I just knew in my heart that someday she'd come back. So she did, and she found me in that room. My hair was way down on my shoulders. And she come back, and I'll never forget that I was laying on them old ragged quilts, Al. And when I woke up and saw her, I thought I had died and went to heaven. I was so glad to see her. God, did she look great. Man, she was decked out. She had a pretty black dress and beads and jewelry and stuff. And it didn't make no difference to me that she'd been doing okay and I hadn't. I was just glad that she'd come back. And she just started right where she left off at abusing me. And whenever she got angry about anything, she took it out on me. And I ran away from home when I was 12. Decided that I was going to go back to Longview. And just before I got there, I was 32 miles away, and I got in trouble. And the old judge gave me an option. He said, you can either go in the Army, or I'm gonna put you in jail. Because I'd been gone a long time riding around. I was almost 18 years old when I went in the military. I remember that the recruiting sergeant, how much he helped me to get me in. I was sitting there trying to fill out the application, the questions and the answers and all that stuff. And he knew about the situation with the judge. And so every time that I would get close to fixing the mark in the wrong block, he'd just look at me and do that, shake his finger and point like, not that one, the next one, you know. So I did so well on the entrance test, I could have qualified for OCS, Officers Candidate School, and I couldn't hardly read and write my name. So I got in the Army, and I spent most of my time in the stockade. Every time I looked around, I was in the stockade doing time there. And with the help of this old sergeant that I was under, while I was there, I got out of there with an honorable discharge. But I had almost 200 days to make up after I had did the time that I enlisted for. I had to remain another 200 days to make up for all the time that I had lost in stockade. Less than 6 months after I was out of the Army, I was in the penitentiary for a burglary charge. They sent me to Clemens Unit, the Texas prison system. And that's a place for first offenders, all black unit, all white guards. And I had a 2-year sentence, and I served about 9 or 10 months on it, and they paroled me out. I was out 38 days, and I violated my parole for an aggravated assault charge, because all of this now is deep-rooted inside of me. I'm just as mean and hard and callous as Emma was. I mean, ever bit, just as tough. And fighting was the name of the game. That's all I knew, and I thought everybody was the enemy. And I hated everything. Everything that I knew, I hated it. It was just a matter of survival, and I didn't care who got hurt as long as it wasn't me.
This is Scan. Albert Sample, now called Old Racehorse, was a hardened career criminal. The more abuse he received in prison, the harder he became.
I was out in 1953, and in the last of 1953, and in 1955, I got a 20-year sentence for armed robbery. And I went to prison. I got the 20 years out of Dallas, Texas, and I went for a year and 14 months. And then they bench warranted me out and gave me a 30-year sentence in some other counties that I had some armed robbery cases in. And that nullified all the time that I had served. I was finally cleared through all the courts, and I went back and started all over again on the 30-year sentence. And this time, that Captain Smooth called me when they was assigning us to our work squads, and he says, "Well, you keep running in and out of this penitentiary. I tell you what I'm gonna do, son. I'm gonna put your yell ass where you can start doing some at 30 years. You catch that number one whole squad when it come out." And that was the worst place they could put you. You're already in hell, and now they're gonna put me in the number one whole squad, which was a double hell. And put me under a guard named Boss Killer Band, because he had killed a whole band of men. He killed 14 men in one day, and he killed two while he worked my squad. And he was a traveling executioner, and he was a killer. I remember the first day that he arrived on Retrieve, which was known as the Bun in Hell, and that's a place that's now down near the Gulf of Mexico. It's in Brazos County. They call it the Brazos Bottoms. He called us all out. It was 25 of us. And he lined us up against the wall. And he told us how he was gonna deal. That if any one of you niggas spew my wood, I'm gonna kill you. If any one of you niggas don't keep them rolls up even, I'm gonna kill you. If any one of you niggas try to run off, I'm gonna kill you. And if I just takes a notion to, I'm gonna kill you. And he looked at all of us lined up here against the wall, and I was the smallest man in that squad. And everybody in that squad was doing 2-3 life sentences, 50 years, 100 years. Had one guy in there doing 365 years. So the attitude in that squad was just like the man that was fixing to start working us. We were no different from him. And he just picked me out of the clear blue sky. He said, "Old Red," and I nearly fell through the floor, you know, through the ground. I said, "God, what does he want to do? Is he fixing to kill me now, you know?" And he called me up to him, and he said, "Can you read and write?" I said, "Yes, sir, a little bit." He said, "Will you take his pencil and pad and go yonder to the far end of that line and start writing them niggas' names down, and put your name down there first?" That meant that I was going to be the lead role, the pace setter for this bully number one whole squad, the fastest, notorious number one workingest crew in the whole penitentiary. And I got to set the pace for that bunch. Nobody wanted me on the lead role. And I sure had a lot of problems with the convicts about that. You know, they tried to wake me down. They tried to run me till I'd drop. I had to race them every day. There's somebody always trying to pull up in front of you, and you have to work in a certain formation, sort of like what we call the buzzard wing. In other words, that lead role man is up here, and everybody angles off to that way, and nobody is supposed to get in front of him at any time. And if they do, it's up to you, the lead role man, to get him back in line with whatever it takes. If you have to chop his head off with the hoe, well, that's all right. And this day, me and another convict in the squad named Railhead Shorty was chopping cotton. He done pulled up in front of me and was trying to burn me out. He was going to work me down, and he couldn't. I beat him to the end of the roll two or three times, and then he gave out and he was ready to quit. And Boss Band tried to run his horse over him and started whooping him with his shotgun and all that kind of stuff because he lost the race. And then he rode his horse over behind me, and he sat there for 5 or 10 minutes. I could feel his eyes just burning a hole in my back. And I was thinking in my mind, God, what's he fixing to do? Because every day he shot in the squad behind us. That was his way of saying we weren't going fast enough. And he called me back. He said, "Oh, Red," he says, "has you ever wondered how come I ain't done killed your yaller ass?" I said, "Oh, Lord, no, sir, boss." He said, "Well, I'm gonna tell you why." He says, "I don't let nobody pick the niggas I kill. I likes to do that myself." I said, "Oh, Lord." He said, "I was watching you race horsing up and down through there on that road a while ago." He said, "I ain't never seen a nigga race horsing on a road like that and clean it that way. Where'd you learn how to chop cotton like that?" I said, "Right here in the penitentiary, boss." He said, "I think that's what I'm gonna call you from now on, old racehorse." He said, "When I call you that nigga, you better answer me, you hear me?" And I said, "Oh, Lord." And after that, everybody in the prison system called me old racehorse. I had been punished so much while I was there. I had been hung on the handcuffs. They cuffed me to the bumpers of pickup trucks and drug me through the fields as a spectacle to show how they do impotent darkies. Niggas that'll talk back. Niggas that won't answer to when I call your name, you won't answer. So they did that to me to show the rest of the convicts how they felt about that. And I never said nothing. The warden and the captain were determined to make me cry out to them. And I hung on them handcuffs, clamped so tight on my arms till I couldn't even move my fingers. And they would string me up to where my toes would just touch the floor, just like Jesus almost. Just like I've hung, just like that. And they come out there and, "How you doing, old racehorse?" I said, "I'm doing just fine, Cap." "When you want me to let you down from there?" I said, "Whenever you get ready, Cap." And they didn't like that. They wanted me to cry out and say, "Oh, have mercy, please," and all that stuff. And I didn't. I bit many holes in the bottom of my lip and swallowed my own blood. Just holding on to the only thing I had was a bottom lip. And I know what it's for to this very day. It ain't just to help you talk. It's something to hold on to. And I wouldn't have let them see me cry. Under no circumstances, because that ain't the place for tears. And every day, every hour, I just got harder and tougher, and nothing inside. Nothing. They couldn't hurt me no more. And I'd been in solitary so many times, it wasn't even funny. God, that's a place. It's almost unbelievable.
It's just like being buried alive. The air gets thin because there's no windows, there's no air coming in. And after a little while, you use up what's in there. You pant for every ounce of air. I used to lay down sideways by my door and put my nose trying to find a crack that I could get just one breath of fresh air. And it was just like, and so quiet, you could hear your own heart beating. Kablunkum, kablunkum, kablunkum. You can hear the blood in your veins. And you can't see nothing. Your hand, you can't even see it before your face. And I was in there one time, and they had put me in there for nothing. I had broke no rule. And there's a concrete slab made out from the wall. And there's a no face basin. And ain't no commode in it. They got a little hole in the center of the floor that you do all your waste in. And God, I've walked in my own dung and my own urine many, many days because you can't see. And I was sitting there on that concrete slab, buck naked. And I had my head lowered and I hid my face with my hands. And I was thinking about how far I'd come. And that was the darkest spot in hell, to be entombed inside of hell, even. I cried for the first time because I know nobody wouldn't see me in there. And I started crying. And I said, God, please help me. And when I moved my hands from over my eyes, it was light in itself. I could see for the first time I'd ever been able to see in there. And I saw the whole thing. And I knew there was something in there with me. I could feel it throughout my whole being. From the last strand of my hair, I could feel it. And it felt so pretty, so beautiful, so good. I knew something loved me. In that second, I knew it. I knew I had felt to be loved. I knew it. And it said to me, don't you worry about a thing, but you must tell them about me. And I stayed in there 28 days.
In solitary confinement, in the depths of despair, he asked God for help, and he got it.
I didn't have nothing inside of me that correlated with God or Jesus. I figured that if he did love somebody, he couldn't love me the way I was. I know what was inside of me. And I felt just like, I ain't gonna ask you for nothing. If you see what's going on and you ain't doing nothing about it, you ain't the man for me. That was the attitude that I had. And it didn't take but just one asking. From the very depths of my soul, I cried it. And it hurt me. That's the funny thing about miracles, I guess, if you want to call them a miracle. Ain't hardly nobody never around when one happens. But you know what you saw. And I know how badly I felt when I went back on that tank and I didn't tell my cellmates about that experience and how what had happened. Because I knew if I had done that, they would have shipped me to the funny farm. They would have said, well, old Ray's horse done cracked up. He done went crazy. Or he done jumped off in a religious bag or something. And that sure was not the truth. I didn't say a word to nobody until 2 years after I was released from that prison. And after I got where I could read good, I certainly read the scriptures. I'll never forget the first page that I opened to start reading the Bible for the first time in my life. I remember opening that book, just sitting there flipping through it, and I stopped in a page
about Job. And I remember the verse that I was reading, the first verse that I ever read in the Bible in my whole life. It said, all the days upon my appointed time, I will wait, because I know that my change shall truly come. And then I was looking at the pictures of Jesus, the way he was hung up and the way he did him. And I certainly could feel sorry for him, because I had had that done to me. They didn't nail, no nails in my hand. But my wrist felt like many times that somebody was stabbing with ice pick, because them cuffs are so tight, the circulation is cut off in your hands. And everything seems to stop right there at your wrist. I know exactly how he felt. Exactly. But he overcame it. And so did old Ray's horse. And I left that solitary cell. And before I could get my Brogans back on to go to the field, the warden sent for me and put me to work in his office as his head bookkeeper. And I didn't know from Yakima about that. And I worked in there for 4.5 years. And that's when I started back to school.
You're listening to Scan. Albert Sample, known in prison as Old Racehorse, was the son of an abusive prostitute by the name of Emma. In spite of being beaten and abandoned by his mother, Albert always wanted her love and acceptance.
And I got a letter.
The only letter that I ever got in the penitentiary was one telling me that Emma was dying. And I thought, what can I do? I mean, I can't do nothing about it. And the next morning, the sheriff was there from Gregg County to pick me up and take me to Gregg County to the Good Shepherd Hospital. They drove me straight on to the hospital. My sister had wrote to the parole board and stuff and told them I was the only son and that my mother was dying, and would they please give me a pardon or just give me a day to come or something. And they did, and they gave me a 3-day reprieve. And I went to Emma's bedside, and I had shackles on my waist and cuffs on my wrists and chains on my legs. And my sister asked the sheriff, said, would you just take them off of him to go in there? There ain't no windows. He can't go nowhere. And he wouldn't do it, so she went and called the sheriff, and he told her, okay, that, you know, he ain't gonna run off nowhere. Hell, I've been knowing him for all his life. So they unchained me right outside of Emma's door. And I walked in there, and she was laying on her side, had them tubes and things running off out of her body, and I hadn't seen her in many, many years. And I remember how she looked so tiny, so pitiful, laying there like that in that bed when she was a beautiful woman. I remembered as a gorgeous woman. I touched her on her shoulder, just barely put my hand on her, and she opened her eyes. And she did her hand like that, beckoning for me to come around in front of the bed where she could see me. And when I walked around in front of the bed, she looked at me and she said, Mama knowed you was coming. She said, I wasn't about to go nowhere till you got here. She said, is me and you all right? Is we still buddies? I said, yes, ma'am, the best kind. And she was dead. And I had to go back to prison, and I stayed another year. And I got out with $10 in my pocket, a shirt and a pair of breeches, no belt, no drawers, no socks, just a shirt, pair of pants, and a pair of navy shoes, and nowhere in the world to go. All my folks was dead. And I went in a halfway house in Houston. The next day, I enrolled at the University of Houston, night classes. The next day, I went to work at a newspaper, the Forward Times. And it started off at $85 a week. In 11 months, I was the general manager.
ramrod and outfit, me, whole race horse. And I started doing the editorial pages about crime versus punishment versus rehabilitation. What do you want your system to do? Who's responsible? Who's gonna hold it accountable for the products it produces, the recycling of these human beings? Does anybody ever say somebody is responsible for this? And the governor must have got a hold to one of those papers. And he called me. And he said, you know, I've been reading some of your articles. He says, and I'm real impressed. He says, and I'm fixing to start up a new program called Social Transition and Readjustment. He says, and I'd like to talk to you about it. He said, do you know anything about this program I'm talking about? Have you heard anything about it? I said, no, sir, I haven't. He said, well, we just passed the Controlled Substance Act law, where marijuana, 4 ounces or less, is a misdemeanor. And it's going to affect a lot of men and women in that penitentiary. He said, I don't want them just getting out without no kind of help. He says, so I'd like to talk to you about it. So I got in my car and I went up there. And out of over 1,000 applicants for that job, I got it. And I went back to that prison that I had been in all those years and got 476 men and women out of there, got them jobs, got them back with their families, helped them over the hump, worked with them. They could always call me before they could get into some trouble. I was always available to them no matter where he was in the state of Texas. I have driven from one side of Texas clean to the other just to try to keep a guy from going back, you know. And at the end of the year, we tracked them for a year and we had only lost 6 people out of that program. And most of these people were multi-recidivists, had been in and out of prisons all their lives. And none of them went back, but just 6. And then I got appointed to the State Bar of Texas, the only non-attorney on the staff, me, old race horse. And there I am directing all of the community-based correctional operations in the state, writing the manual for halfway house operations, me. And it was at that point where I got to thinking more and more every day and remembering what that voice said to me. You must tell him about me. And I started talking to my wife about it. I couldn't sleep. I got where it was just bugging me to death. I could do nothing. On my job, I'm a good, hard worker. I work long and hard. And it was getting to the point where I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stay in my office. I had to get out of there. It was just bugging me to death. And I went home one day and I told my wife, I said, I just got to write that book again. I can't help it. And she said, well, I'll help you. She said, we'll both quit. So I resigned my job. And she was working at Lockheed. She resigned her job. We sold our home to stake us with enough money to give us the time to do it. And we, all our friends, we just tickled them to death because I let her cut my hair with the scissors. And then she let me cut hers. And we both looked so funny that we was ashamed to go anywhere. We couldn't go no further than the 7-Eleven down on the corner. And it was hot in the summertime, and I'd walk around with a toboggan cap on my head because my head looked like a picked chicken. And hers did the same way. But we did that so that we wouldn't leave, that we would stay right there. And for 9 months, I mean, I barely went beyond the block from my house. I would sit and type and type and type. And as fast as I'd finish a sheet, bless old Carol's heart, I'd pull it out and give it to her. She would edit it. Then when I'd get to a point where I would stop, then we would edit together what I had already written, and then she would retype it, and we was ready to go. But it was so funny about the first part of the book. the beginning of 1909. I had no earthly idea where to begin that book. The prison part was so easy to write, it wasn't even funny, because it was so fresh in my memory. And I was sitting out in the backyard after I had written the second half of the book and was through with it. And I said, there's some more to my life besides just being in the penitentiary. There's got to be some more to it than that. And I just said to God, I said, show me. Please, sir. And that night, I wish Carol was here to tell you this. It's the truth. Because I had gone 2 weeks and I hadn't been able to type one word. Just everything just shut down. I couldn't write a line and it was killing me because I wanted to finish it so badly. And I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I told her, I woke her up, I said, I got it. I said, let's go. And I went nonstop until I wrote the first 130 pages of that book. Just like that. And my life has never been the same. Never been the same. And every day of my life, when I wake up, when I can open my eyes, that's the first thing I say. Thank you for bringing me out of the darkness one more time. Thank you.
You've been listening to a remix version of Scan, an electronic sweep of the horizon discovering God's activity in the world. We featured Albert Sample, known in prison as Race Haas. Scan is a production of Select Learning, a continuing education program of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.